Welcome to The Lobbying Show, the show about the people of government relations, how they got into it, and what their jobs entail, what works and what doesn't. I am the host, Jim O'Brien. Well, here is another episode, but I have to be honest with you, we're in the middle of August and things are a little slow, so we are pulling up an old show that we recorded a while back with Carl Szabo from NetChoice. Carl is a great guy, and NetChoice is a great organization, and I hope you enjoy it. Remember to follow us on Twitter and rate us on iTunes. Good, bad, or indifferent, whatever you think. Enjoy the show. So, Carl, you are the senior policy counsel at an organization called NetChoice, based where else but Washington, D.C. I'm gonna let you explain what NetChoice does, but basically it's all about e-commerce and defending and protecting e-commerce. You're also an attorney and an adjunct professor at George Mason Law School, where you teach a seminar on internet privacy. But more importantly than all this, you worked for a year where you were responsible for the market development promoting Red Bull. So from Red Bull to lobbying, very good training, Carl. I like that.
Surprisingly similar, actually. It's all about sales.
I bet. So what did you actually do working with Red Bull?
Quite simply, I went around and found bars, restaurants, and nightclubs that had not yet begun carrying the product and explained to them the benefits of the beverage and encouraged them to purchase a product that cost them $1.33 per SKU. And it was a blast, but it taught me kind of the nuances and intricacies of sales. And let's be clear, most of life is all about sales. You're either selling yourself, your services, or the interests of an industry or a group of businesses. And so it really set a great roadmap for where I am now.
And how long did you do that for?
I did that for about a year.
And was that also in Washington, D.C.?
Correct.
Okay. Correct. So I was why don't we take a step back for a minute. I see that you went to Rice University, which actually, reading your resume and doing a little research, heard a very interesting story about the founding of Rice University and how that all came about. I don't know if you're familiar with that. But anyways, where did you grow up?
I actually grew up here in Washington, D.C. I was born at GW Hospital and grew up in the area. My parents were both federal employees. And I really became inculcated in kind of the DC culture, seeing firsthand how government operates and the benefits and kind of some of the challenges of living in the DC area. And Jim, to go back to your reference to the founding of Rice University, I highly encourage listeners to take a look at it because it's a great murder mystery and the butler did it. So it's a really interesting story.
Well, why don't we jump ahead and why don't you just tell the listeners about it? Because it is, I don't know it that well, but it is a fascinating story. The only thing I know about Rice University is that we refer to it as the Harvard of the South.
So William Marsh Rice, rich millionaire, suddenly died and his will went missing. And suddenly the butler came up with a copy of the will that apparently left everything to him. And it's believed that the butler might have poisoned Mr. Rice, but as you mentioned, Mr. Baker, James Baker the First, the grandfather of James A. Baker the Third, who was Secretary of State under George H.W. Bush, was the trust and estates attorney for William Marsh Rice and made sure that the correct will was used, which gave the bulk of the Rice estate to the creation of Rice University. So it's a really fascinating story, a murder mystery with a butler and a fake will and a battle that ultimately created what I think is a great school. So
yeah, that is very interesting. So how did you pick Rice University being from Washington, D.C.?
It kind of
besides being you know, one of the best schools in the country.
Yeah, it was literally my grandmother's next door neighbor's son was a professor there, and that's how Rice ended up on my radar. It was, you know, I applied to a bunch of schools, got into a bunch of schools, and one of the things was that Rice, and I think it still is today, considered, you know, the best value, quote unquote. At the time when I went to Rice, it was literally half the price, full tuition, room and board, half the price of Northwestern, Penn, GW, Georgetown, every other university in the country. Because one of the things that they had done was taken the large endowment for the university and used it to defer the cost of tuition. So that, coupled with the fact that as soon as I visited there, I knew that that was the place I wanted to go, were the two factors that really led me to going to Rice University. And it's a fantastic university. I love it. And it actually put me in a position to meet a bunch of Rice alums who have really helped me along my career.
Fascinating. And then from there, you went on to law school, back to your home turf of Washington, D.C., at CUA, as we refer to it. At that time, did you begin focusing on communications and internet and e-commerce and all that?
Yeah, one of the things that really drove me to Catholic law is something called the Communications Law Institute. And this was a program created by Harvey Zuckman about 20 or so years ago. And it's a specialization within Catholic law to focus on communications law. They have adjunct professors from the FCC, from the FTC, from private practice, and they all come in and they teach really specialized classes focusing on these specific issues. So I had a class specifically on FCC regulations. I had a class specifically on copyright law. I had a class specifically on cyber law. And that was what I really loved about the CUA program. And that's actually what kept me at CUA Law. It was this ability to really zero in on this Communications Law Institute. And as a result, you will see many, many Communications Law Institute graduates in high-level positions throughout the FCC, FTC, and private practice. So we've become a really good group of people focused on helping each other progress in the communications industry.
And did you have some interesting internships while you were at law school?
So I actually took a unique approach, not totally unique. I was an evening student. So I actually worked during the day.
Oh, wow.
And went to school at night. And
so what was your day job?
My day job was I was a federal employee for the U.S. Office of Government Ethics. Then I got an opportunity to go out to L.A. and work for the Motion Picture Association doing anti-piracy work. So that was an opportunity I couldn't turn down. So I left my government job, literally threw all my stuff in a car and drove across the country.
Wow. And was Senator Dodd the head of it at that point, or was this before his time?
It was just before him.
Okay.
And spent a summer in L.A. doing work there, came back, and got an opportunity to work as a law clerk for the law firm of Arnold & Porter. And I did that as my day job, and I did law school by night, and basically through my graduation.
Wow. So Arnold & Porter, that little small boutique firm.
Yeah, you might have heard of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And then so after law school, what'd you do, and how'd you eventually end up at NetChoice?
Post-law school, I graduated into the wonderful downturn of the economic market that we recently enjoyed in 2008, 2009. As a result, the law firm that I was going to deferred the start dates for all of its incoming first-year associates, and that was the law firm of Wildman, Harold, Allen, and Dixon. And basically, I was given kind of this lull. I had studied for the bar exam, I'd finished taking the bar, and now I had between the months of August and my start date in March to either just kind of sit around or do something really cool. And I'd always wanted to work for the Entertainment Software Association, so I called up one of my colleagues who worked there and told him I was interested, and spent the next couple of months as an intern doing anti-piracy work for the Entertainment Software Association. Great opportunity, loved it.
And then just for our people listening that may not be familiar with it, can you just tell us about what they do and who their members are?
Yeah, the best way to describe Entertainment Software Association, or ESA, is they're kind of the motion picture association for video games. And their members include companies like Activision, Sony, Microsoft, Nintendo, and Electronic Arts, to kind of name the big ones. So that's kind of what they do. It's the advocacy arm for video games to both Congress and consumers.
Yep. And so do you eventually leave that and go to the law firm in March?
That's right. The law firm by then had said, you know, they deferred start dates to March. So my wife and I put all of our stuff in a car, move out to Chicago, and I then begin doing IP law for the law firm. And I did that for a while, and long story short, through the grapevine, there was an opportunity here to come to NetChoice and kind of do advocacy work. And once I got that opportunity, that was another one that I just couldn't turn down.
Right. Yeah, so you now have been at NetChoice for 5 years. It always amazes me, Carl, is that no matter you ask you or Steve a question on any one of these issues, whether it's privacy, home sharing, you know, any of these issues, and you not only know the topic and can explain it, but you look at a bill and you just instantly say, oh, this is the Minnesota version, or no, this is the Arizona version. And so my take on your job is that you obviously have these members, and you can tell us about them and what your focus is, but you have these issues that you work on, and you're not only an expert on the issue, and you not only fly around the country and, you know, talk to legislators about these issues, but a big part of it is educating people and explaining it to people in a way that they can understand, because a lot of them are quite frankly pretty complicated, and they appear to be one thing, and what you do a very good job at is explaining what it really is. You know, whether it's an issue of privacy, and a lot of things get labeled as privacy and fall under that umbrella, but when you begin to dig down, it's really about a lot more than that. So tell us just a little bit about NetChoice and what you focus on and what you all are doing.
Thanks, Jim. I think you laid it out pretty well, the groundwork. NetChoice, quite simply, our guiding mission is breaking down barriers to e-commerce. Originally founded back in the early '00s, and one of the first issues we addressed was for a member 1-800-CONTACTS. And back then, you could not ask your optometrist for your prescription. They didn't have to give it to you. And that sounds ridiculous today.
That's crazy.
It sounds crazy, but what the optometrist would do is say, oh, you've got 20/80 vision. I will sell you this box of contacts right now. They didn't want to give you the opportunity to take your prescription to somebody else who could probably offer you the contacts at a lower price.
Right.
And it actually took an act of Congress to guarantee you your right to get your prescription to your eye exam. And now you can take your contacts, your contact prescription to 1-800-CONTACTS. You can take it to the local pharmacy. You can take it to Costco. And that was kind of where we started. And since then, we've kind of been taking that guiding mission and going forward. Now, jump forward to 2015, 2016. What's the new barriers that we're seeing being erected? That literally there was one that just is probably going up in the next 48 hours in New York, and that's around the issue of home sharing. Mm-hmm. Historically, if I needed a room to rent, I would go to the coffee shop bulletin board, or I'd see a flyer on the street, or I'd see something taped to a lamppost, and I'd pull a sticker off, it has a phone number, I'd call it, and they'd say, oh yeah, you can come and rent this room. Well, that was really inefficient. It was really hard for people with rooms to rent, and it was really hard for people looking to rent rooms. Well, now, through the internet, we're able to match people, renters and owners. And that's what these home sharing services do, like HomeAway or Airbnb. Well, unfortunately, it's so efficient that the incumbents in the market are feeling threatened. And what they're trying to do is use the argument of consumer protection for the purposes of competition prevention.
You hear consumer protection a lot in these issues. They come up quite a bit, whether it's insurance requirements or whatever it may be. And this battle is currently going on. You're fighting one in New York right now.
Yes, there was a bill that was passed by the New York legislature. Quite simply, it doesn't outlaw home sharing, but it makes it illegal to advertise rooms for rent. And this one, I think, is a pretty slam dunk violation of Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which protects websites and services from being liable for the content provided by others. I think it's a potential violation of First Amendment free speech. And there are a couple other legal arguments that I don't think this law will be able to overcome. So should it become law, and we're hoping the governor decides to veto it, but should it become law, you know, expect some lawsuits to potentially enjoin it.
Yeah.
Because it's really just a giant overreach. But it's not just in home sharing that we're seeing these consumer protection arguments used for competition prevention. The other kind of big example would be ride sharing, where once again, you are just using a platform. It may be called Uber, it may be called Lyft, it may be called GetMe or something else to connect people driving with people looking for a ride. A good example, I myself am a driver for Lyft.
Are you really?
Yeah, and the reason that I do it is, here in DC, the metro is shutting down essentially for the entire summer. Well, it costs a lot to park downtown DC, but there are a lot of people up where I live who rely on the metro and are going to need a ride downtown. So Lyft Line is a feature that I say, here's where I'm going, and it connects me with people looking for a ride downtown. Mm-hmm. And at the end, I get a little cash out of it to help me pay for parking. Historically, we call this slugging in the DC metropolitan area, where people would literally stand in lines and drivers would pick them up for purposes of HOV access.
Yep.
But now we're using platforms to make that more efficient. But that's all it is. It's just a new way to do an old thing.
So not only do you get to use the HOV, but you get a little money to help pay for parking.
That's exactly it.
That's
and
great.
These individuals get to their jobs. So it's really a win-win-win.
Yep. And then what is the status of the home sharing battle? The other place that's gotten a lot of news is in San Francisco. What's going on there?
San Francisco basically passed an ordinance, and just yesterday, Airbnb filed suit to what's called enjoin the law. That's basically ask a court to prevent the law from taking effect. And there were a number of arguments that Airbnb made, but the best one is this thing called Section 230, which I alluded to earlier. And just to give you a little bit of background, then I'll explain what's going on. Section 230 was written back in 1996, part of what's called the Communications Decency Act. But back before 1996, if I were to post a comment on, let's say, the WashingtonPost.com comment section, and I said, Jim O'Brien is stupid. Well, back before 1996, there was an argument that you, Jim O'Brien, could bring suit against the Washington Post.
All right, well, right now I'm in favor of that because, you know, you could have picked a lot of adjectives. You know,
yeah, exactly.
Funny, smart, greatest podcast in the, you know, but, you know, okay, we'll go with, anyways, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. So back before 1996, you could have brought suit against Washington Post for hosting that content.
Right.
But then Section 230 said the platform is not liable. And this makes sense because it would almost be ludicrous to hold services like Facebook or YouTube or the comment section liable for the content posted by others. That just, it would make those business models and those services just unworkable. And that's been on the books for years. Well, Airbnb brought suit in San Francisco saying the law that holds Airbnb liable for the content posted by others, in this case, homeowners, is a violation of this law.
Oh, interesting.
And it really gets to the tenets of and the core of the law that allowed the internet to flourish, Section 230. It's the law, you know, it's the most important law you've never heard of. And once again, Airbnb is just really a bulletin board where people can post.
Yep.
When you really break it down, that's all it is. And that's what they're arguing. And they're saying, we're just a bulletin board. Other people are posting content. And under Section 230, this federal law that's been around for 30 years, we're not responsible.
And so now most of the state legislatures have probably finished for the year. Is that correct?
That's correct. There are a couple still in session. California is an example of one. New York is wrapping up. Only a handful of states are still in session. And most states that are still in session are in session because of kind of battles over the budget.
Okay. When does California finish up?
December. They're one of the few that actually runs the whole year.
Oh, they do? Like Massachusetts and others. Yeah.
Yeah. Texas runs for a couple of months every 2 years. Virginia had a 45-day session this year. So, yeah, but for the most part, states are wrapping up. But that doesn't mean that state legislatures are done for the year, because they're always looking to the next session.
Right, right. And getting ready. And it doesn't mean that agencies aren't working on something or the attorney generals. And so once most of the legislatures wrap up in the spring or early summer, you probably spend most of your summer going to different conferences and speaking on panels and working on model legislation.
Yes, but also it's important to note that even if the states are done, that doesn't mean the cities are. And we've been seeing a real growth of activity at the city level recently. Austin is a good example, as Austin recently passed two ordinances, one regarding ride sharing, which resulted in Uber and Lyft leaving the city, and an ordinance regarding home sharing.
And so now you not only have to focus on all the states, but you also have cities and municipalities that are passing these types of ordinances. Boy, you are going to be busy.
Oh, yeah. But it's fun.
So now during the year, when the legislatures are in session, you cover the entire country, correct?
Correct. We cover state, we cover local, federal, and international. So my boss, Steve Del Bianco, right now is in Helsinki at what's called the ICANN, what's called an ICANN meeting. So, and that's a whole nother 2 hour long conversation.
In one short sentence, just tell listeners what ICANN is.
Okay. I'll try it as short as I can. ICANN is the thing that runs domain names. This is the best way to describe that. When you type in any URL into your web browser, ICANN is the one who gets you from entering in that domain name to where you're trying to go.
Right. So getting back to you, so an issue will come up in any number of states, and you will then work with local people on the ground, come in, offer your expert advice, maybe help with suggesting changes to legislation, if it can be fixed, describing if it can't be fixed, why it has to be stopped, working with the local people on the ground. So you spend a lot of your time, I would imagine, between January and June, flying from state to state and providing testimony and supporting the local people on the ground.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's a sad state of affairs when I'm getting status on airlines by doing segments. Because when I realized I'd had 35 flights in just a couple of months last year, it was a
wow.
a stark realization for me, the amount of time I spent in an airport.
I can only imagine. And are there, I would imagine there's certain states that are more active or probably more important than others. Obviously, you mentioned earlier, New York and California are clearly large states and important. Are there other states that seem to come up quite a bit, or you seem to spend a lot of time, or is it really just across the board?
You know, what we've been seeing more and more is every state is getting engaged. I was in Helena, Montana 2 weeks ago. Before that, I was in Lansing, Michigan. Mm-hmm. I testified in Cheyenne, Wyoming. And these are not exactly the states you would typically think of when you're thinking tech.
Yep.
A lot of people have the tendency to focus on the big states, like you mentioned, like New York or California. But any state legislature can take a bad bill and make it a law in as little as a week.
Yep.
And the way that the internet works, because a website doesn't stop at state borders.
Right.
It doesn't change suddenly when it goes from Maryland to Virginia to Kansas. If one state passes a law, that almost has the tendency to percolate across the entire nationwide infrastructure.
Well, and it's one thing you have explained to me in the past, if that, you know, one state passes a law, you know, many companies can't have a separate policy for one particular state. They're just going to have to change the policy across the board.
Exactly.
Yeah, so it makes it very, very complicated. What are some of the things when you go into, let's say you're going into California to testify or to work on an issue, why don't you just describe like a typical day?
One of the things that I like to explain to my students and basically anybody else I'm talking to about this issue, even colleagues, going in there and saying, don't do this, is never a good argument. It's just not. It's not a winning argument.
Right.
Because it's not...
No one likes to be told not to do something.
Well, it's not dispositive of doing something.
Right.
Saying
they obviously want to do something because they put the bill in.
Exactly. I mean, my son, I tell him, don't touch the stove. He'll ask why.
Right.
And I explain to him, well, if you touch a stove, you'll get burned because it's hot.
Right.
He says, oh, okay, that makes sense now.
Right.
So explaining to a legislator why there are problems with the bill. And usually it involves the idea of what's called unintended consequences.
Yep.
Unintended consequences of a bill. If you do this, here's the unintended consequence. A good example would be data breach notification laws, which we've seen a spat of since the Target breach a couple of years ago. And the idea behind data breach notification laws is when there is a breach of a company's systems, you should tell the constituents, the impacted users.
So the one that you're referring to is Target, the retail store, had their customers' accounts breached. And so the issue is, when should Target tell the customers that their personal information has been compromised, and what personal information has been compromised? Is that correct?
That's exactly it.
Okay.
And it sounds like a great idea.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Yeah, there's a breach. I want to know about it.
Right. Right.
Everybody should know about it. In fact, I should know about it in 48 hours, let's say. From identification of the breach to telling me should be no less than 2 days.
Right.
And sounds like a great idea. And there's a reason why legislators introduce bills like that, because it does sound like a great idea. But then you explain to them, well, hold on a sec. What if we want to work with law enforcement to make sure that we can track down the criminals? Because as soon as we notify the public that
the bad guys know,
that we know that there's a breach, the bad guys are going to run underground. Okay, yeah. Well then, okay, that's good.
So you would create an exemption for that particular...
For law enforcement, right.
Right, right.
Then, well, for example, the Target breach, it actually took them more than 40 days to identify the total universe of impacted users. So what happens is, if I have to notify impacted users within 48 hours, I'm just going to tell everybody.
Right, because you don't even know the universe yet.
Right. So now you are basically telling people your data has been breached when necessarily I might not have been. Well, then what about what I call the over-notification problem? If your listeners remember Windows Vista is the example of over-notification, where anytime you made any change to your computer, you got a pop-up saying there's a change about to be made to your computer. Well, we don't want data breach notifications to turn into junk mail. We want users to realize when there is a breach that's likely to impact them financially and to address it.
So what what you want to try to avoid is that if you write this law, if this law passes the way that it is, what Target's going to have to do to protect itself is basically tell all of its customers every year or every month that your data might have been compromised. And it'll get to the point where people will just ignore these notices.
Exactly. I mean, a good example would be the Office of Personnel and Management. The U.S. Office of Personnel and Management famously had a data breach. And a lot of data was stolen on government employees who've had background checks. I was one of those employees. Well, the OPM gave every impacted individual free credit monitoring. These are federal employees or former federal employees who've gotten this or family of. I would almost stake the car on it that not every individual has taken advantage of that free credit monitoring. And it's because, I would argue, in part because of this over-notification problem, where people just assume that their data is going to get breached and just aren't doing anything to really protect it. So that's an example of where I go into a legislator's office and say, look, I understand what you're trying to do, but here are some of the unintended consequences. Another would be, there was, and this is why I was in Helena, Montana, it was a requirement for any business collecting personal information to have a privacy policy.
That's a little broad.
It's a little broad, but sounds like a good idea. If you're collecting personal information, you should have a privacy policy. Mm-hmm. And I used the example of the Montana Meat Company, where you can actually go to their website and buy meat online and give them your name, address, credit card information, and they'll ship you, you know, meat. It's like Omaha Steaks type services.
Yep.
Well, they didn't have a privacy policy. So you're basically telling a bunch of ranchers that they need to hire a lawyer and write a privacy policy when privacy policies aren't really written for consumers. They're written for other lawyers. So I was asking the legislature, A, what's the benefit to consumers? And B, what's the unintended consequences to small businesses like the Montana Meat Company?
And sometimes the problem or the difficulty with those types of bills is that you end up writing so many exceptions or exclusions that the list just goes on and on. And so I'm sure what you probably spent a lot of time doing is just get it written in a way where it achieves their goals but doesn't have to have, you know, 30 exemptions under the rule.
Right. And what America's been great about, as opposed to other parts of the world, is what we call permissionless innovation. And a lot of other parts of the world have broad-based laws saying you may not do this, and then you have to go and beg the government for the opportunity to innovate. I like to say it's innovation at the speed of government.
that's pretty good.
So rather than doing that, and what America's been really good about is what's called sectoral legislation, where if we see a problem, if we see a bad action, if we see a misuse, then we will write a narrow law or regulation to address that bad practice, but not outlaw the entire industry or the entire opportunity to innovate.
Right. And then so in your recent trip, so you would go in, meet with legislators on that bill. You obviously do a lot of testifying in addition to that.
Yeah, we do a lot of written and in-person testimony. Just yesterday, I was talking to a reporter on internet sales tax. So we get out there as much as we can, both in media, in print, and in person.
Yeah.
And
do you like testifying?
Oh, I love it. It's a lot of fun. It's about as close to the courtroom as I'll ever get.
Yep.
And it gets back to kind of my debating history back in the day.
And but more and much more freewheeling than a courtroom.
Yes, exactly. There's no
judge, no procedure, no evidence.
Right, exactly. No federal rules of evidentiary procedure. I can actually make compelling arguments to a judge, who in this case it happens to be the legislators.
Right.
And at the same time, we work at the federal level. We make similar arguments before commissioners, at, for example, the FTC, FCC, or over at the NTIA when they do rulemakings, and try to educate them about unintended consequences of proposed rules or actions.
Yep. So what part of your job do you enjoy the most?
Probably the opportunity to deal with the wide spread of issues that constantly keep me on my toes. And I was actually just coming up with a list of the things that I've worked on in the past week. In part includes internet sales tax, home sharing, ride sharing, daily fantasy sports, interest-based ads or online tracking, depending on how you want to talk about it, facial recognition privacy, and privacy and regulations surrounding UAVs or drones, however you want to call them.
Right.
And I'm actually dealing later today with what happens to your privacy and your digital accounts in the afterlife. So that is
quite a wide range. So what about your job that you don't particularly enjoy, if there's anything that stands out?
I mean, there are challenges, like with any job, just trying to, you know, stay on top of all the issues and, you know, making sure that I'm doing the best advocacy for my members that I can do. And
yeah. I would imagine at times you are probably spread pretty thin in certain busy months when all the legislatures are in session.
Yeah, the busy months are definitely the most challenging. But the nice thing is my boss, Steve, and I really have a good balance. We have a fantastic working relationship, and we're able to basically achieve everything that our members ask of us.
Yeah. And that's Steve Del Bianco, just a longtime advocate in the industry and very well known by people in the industry. All right. Well, Carl, this has been great. We appreciate it very much. And I'm sure everyone will be seeing you next year at the all the various state capitals around the country.
Yep, and they can always follow us at netchoice.org. Twitter is @netchoice, and I'm @CarlZabo.
Yeah, and all Carl's information, for those of you that are interested, is on his on the NetChoice website. So you can definitely find him there. All right, Carl, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Joe.